The national anthem. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous night, for the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, and now for a man who needs no introduction and who promised he wouldn't speak unless he got one. No introduction, I tell you, but he does need a psychiatrist. Our guest speaker of the day, Paul Hinderly. My fellow Americans, it is with pride that I place before this convention the name of Dwight David Eisenhower. Oh, last time I spoke. Democracy. Democracy. I don't know what you feel when you hear that word, but my mind goes back to where it all began. Greece. Greece of the Greeks. Thank you. Democracy comes from those two great Greek words, demakra, meaning fruit, and racy, meaning quick. And the two of them together have meant an awful lot in American history as well. We remember with pride at the Battle of Gettysburg when the Union troops, having eaten nothing but cherries for 3 or 4 days, were unable to run physically once the battle began and therefore laid down their stakes and were unable to pick them up. Thereby, in spite of Pickett's charge and everything else, won that glorious battle and turned back the Southern rebels. But to get back to Greece, where it all began. Plato didn't like it. No, Plato felt that democracy was ruinous to the health of the body politic. In fact, if I have my quote correctly, Plato felt there were five kinds of democracy. There was pure, there was impure, there was contaminated, there was polluted, and there was daily politics in Chicago. Thank you. Rome. Rome was unable to understand democracy because they couldn't speak Greece. And onward into the Middle Ages, those long, dark, hallowed corridors of time when time itself seemed to run out. And, yes. Thank you. I have been... There will be... I'm ashamed to say there will be more, yes. I have been asked, what makes America great? I will say it in three words. Cheese. Great. Cheese, yes, cheese. To continue on my introduction about psychiatrists, thank you. What can I say about them? When one speaks of psychiatrists, one talks of an insidious attack upon the body politic of America. Mine has been attacking me for some 15 years already. Why do you think they call them shrinks? I have been told that psychiatrists feel that one-third of the American people are subclinically neurotic. Or, as my favorite psychiatrist says, stark, staring bonkers. I, too, have felt that. I have felt that. That need of bonkers and stark and staring, especially after waking up screaming after eating last night's noodle hot dish. Thank you. I have heard America singing, especially on the couch. There is no need, my friends, no need even to look back farther than 30 years when Franklin Delano Roosevelt told us that he was an old campaigner and he loved a good fight. And 10 years later, Harry S. Truman said, Senator Barkley and I are going to win this election and don't you forget it. And 15 years later, John F. Kennedy stood before the American people and said, Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. A scant 10 years after that famous speech, Richard Nixon, in four famous words, spelled out the word for our tricentennial. I am not a crook. Yes, friends, oratory is part of it all. And you are part of it, I am part of it, ever since those early Greeks, high in those Attican hills, playing their little flutes and pipes of Pan, first started to sing sweetly to themselves of the love of Crassi and Demma. I would like to end today's speech on a false note. No. With a song. A song that is much a song for our time. A song that you can all join in on if you're a true-born American man or a woman. And if you don't happen to be true-born American or a man or a woman, you can join in anyway as a simple mark of common respect. Might I have my lovely wife? Not here. Chorus master, the words are from an old... I'd like everyone to join in. Voice is ready? We'll sing it through twice. When you're feeling kind of blue, and you don't know what to do, when you've got a lot of trouble on your mind, if you face them with a smile, it will make your life worthwhile, and you'll find that every cloud is silver-lined. Sing this happy song with me. Just a simple melody. What though skies above are gray, you can face the world today if you'll only learn to say. Though your life is filled with care, you will hear it everywhere. Though the world may wear a frown, here's a way to win renown. Tell them as they strap you down. Everybody, once again, friends. When your life is filled with care, you will hear it everywhere. Though the world may wear a frown, here's a way to win renown. Tell them as they strap you down. Thank you. God bless you. We're from America. I don't need this. I have many people to thank for this wonderful day. My mother, my lovely wife, my ward-healing politicians, and the wonderful people in the kitchen who make up America's melting pot. Have you ever thought of it, ladies and gentlemen? That every person you know can be described by a food, or a sauce, or a fruit. I've known many in the kitchen who are the latter. And now, to lovers of fruit salad everywhere, especially those whose brains are scrambled, when your life is filled with care, you will hear it everywhere. Though the world may wear a frown, here's a way to win renown. Tell them as they strap you down. The audiences at Holden Village are the greatest in the world. Thank you.
Today's Matins is based on the gospel for this week, which is Luke 9, 18 to 24. I'll read it for you. Once when Jesus was praying in private and his disciples were with him, he asked them, who do the crowds say that I am? They replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others that one of the prophets of long ago has come back to life. But what about you, he asked, who do you say I am? Peter answered, the Christ of God. Jesus strictly warned them not to tell this to anyone, and he said, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, and he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Then he said to them all, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it. This morning I would like to deal with a very American aspect of our lives. And I don't think anybody in here has not been involved with this before, or for those of us who are younger, who won't be involved with it in the future. And that part of American life that I'm talking about is known as our first love, or infatuation. Whichever, infatuation describes it better, I guess. And I consider myself somewhat of an expert, because I've spent a great deal of my 26 years infatuated with somebody, somewhere. And the time I wasn't infatuated, I was either in love with or totally fed up with. With women. So now that I've given you my credentials for this emotional disease, we'll continue. And I'd like for you all to kind of reflect back and think about your very first your very first love, the very first time you ever felt something emotional for someone who wasn't a parent or a relative. And think about what it was about this particular person that that attracted you to them. I would like to deal with the younger, when you were younger, your very first one, for those of us who are still involved with infatuation. It gets more complicated the older you get. So we'll just deal with the little things, you know. Like some of the things that really attracted you to somebody, like maybe buck teeth. Or freckles. Buck teeth, freckles, dimples, red hair, or just coming to the realization that you weren't the only fat person in the world who wore both glasses and braces. And think about that for a while, and think about and reflect on the time and energy you spent just kind of hanging out somewhere, going out of your way to be somewhere because you knew that certain person would be there eventually. You know, you just stood there and you didn't do anything, you didn't say anything. You just kind of hung around in disguise, maybe. I personally hid behind plants and doors and trees. I was really shy and into nature at the same time. But, you know, think of the energy you spent hanging around. And then when you think about infatuation and all it entails, all the countless times you spent maybe walking a certain way or even following somebody home, and then think about the one-sidedness of infatuation, how there's not much give and take in infatuation. It's all, it's just kind of admiring somebody from afar. And there's not much sharing. There's nothing reciprocal, really, in infatuation at all. It's just a very dreamy-like situation. And I think about this in relation to today's gospel, where Christ was talking to his disciples and he asked them first, who do some say that I am? And then he asked Peter personally, who do you say that I am? And he said, the Christ. And then Jesus tells him about the suffering that he'd go through and that they'd have to do likewise, pick up their cross and follow him and do the same. And I think Christ was speaking to infatuation because he didn't want the disciples, or he didn't want his followers to be infatuated with his power or with his name or with the fact that, you know, some thought he was a prophet, some thought he was a prophet come to life again. He didn't want them to be confused, and he didn't want them to follow him in the light of infatuation. And Jesus opened up, and he told his disciples just what they'd have to do in order to be a follower of him. And I think what he was saying was, you have to outgrow infatuation. Any type of relationship that develops, it has to be more than infatuation. 90% of the time, the person we're infatuated knows nothing about it. And what Jesus is saying here is that, in a sense, he's saying, let's do more than infatuation. Let's have a love thing, a more of a a marriage, if you will, a spiritual marriage between the Trinity and my flock. And a marriage involves quite a few things. A marriage involves maybe daily dying to infatuation, the fact that who you're married to, your spouse, will have occasional diarrhea or occasional bad breath or occasional bad moods. And Christ is saying to be a follower of him, to be married to him in the spirit, we would have occasional suffering, occasional pain, occasional rejection. And he's saying these things to his disciples and to us too, really, to let us know that the gospel is a much more glorious type of relationship than a one-sided type of infatuation. The gospel is love at its peak. It's a sharing type of thing. It's a reciprocal type of thing. There's give and take. There's talking with the Father. There's not just staring and standing there all glassy-eyed and just hanging around. It involves a purpose. It involves a commitment. There's no commitment in infatuation. You're just there. You just hang around. And in a true love relationship, you have to make a commitment. And Jesus is saying here that I want more than infatuation. I want love, which involves a commitment, which involves knowing me for who I am, which involves coming into my bedroom, if you will, and watching me in the morning, watching me brush my teeth, watching me comb my hair, watching me before I make myself presentable, knowing me totally for who I am. And if we do this, Christ promises us that he won't leave us standing around in corners staring at him. He won't leave us wondering how he feels about us, or doesn't he really love me or like me? The gospel promises more than that. And the gospel asks for more than just to stare at Christ and admire Christ from afar. And picking up your cross daily involves death to daily dying to sin, daily dying to just infatuation with Christ. So, glory be to God for infatuation. Thanks be to God that it's over and done with.
Myself was very hard building it,
sure.
And I would like to thank Meredith for all the help that she's been. Well, Meredith, you come on, you get there. You get your
phone. That surprised you, Dick.
Thank you, Bicentennial Fish.
And Rudy and Doris Edmonds also get one of these for their contributions to this occasion. Thank you very, very much. What do we do next around here?
Boat race, is that right now? Is that scheduled for right now?
Yeah. Well, it's 3:30. Who's in charge of the boat race? Olden Village, complete with mermaids.
And we rent you to start the boat race. What do we have on the boats over here?
Do we register or what do we do?
Pardon? Oh, you just put them in the water.
Can I put them in here?
Why don't we go on the other end of that gate down there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you want to make a good choice remarks?
Well, I have here a dream boat made up of a banana boat, a big pine cone, and some tulip leaves. No, poppy. Poppy.
Oh, yeah, poppy.
I hope it wins. Thank
Pebbles.
You.
Thank you. Would you like to make a few remarks for the tape?
Well, this boat is named after me, and it says Trenton or Bust on it because it's such a good boat. And it will win, so you can count on that. The Deborah Steinemann. Yes.
Well, good luck. Got a few choice remarks for me? What?
Not a one. You haven't got it turned on.
Oh, I don't.
How come they change their minds so often?
Well, they didn't get down here beforehand to figure it out.
I thought women only had a right to change their mind.
I guess that's something, there's something to that. Some people act like women once in a while.
You four go. Ready, set, go. Knock on that.
We hope to get a generator for this. Now, you know, this mill only turns 23 and a half RPM, and most of these generators run anywhere from 1750 up to 2800. So until we know what type of generator we're going to get and what the RPM is going to be, we can't build a transmission. So I'll have to wait to build a transmission until we know what RPM our generator is, because we gotta speed it up to that RPM that we need for a generator. And this is going to be a direct current generator. So you people that like to read and have never read under a perfect light, then you come to Holden Village and read under one of these 40 watt direct current lamps, and then when you go and read under a AC lamp, it'll blink. This we know this from New Guinea.
1977, I think it would be appropriate to open this fateful program with a chorus of In the Sweet By and By. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore. Now on this great 4th of July, ladies and gentlemen, we want to be patriotic and remember all the famous American funerals we have known. It was on the great year, I believe, when Warren G. Harding, they thought was poisoned from food poisoning, and they had a very faithful funeral for him, and they all marched on into the funeral parlor to look, and so they said, one man said, "So this is the president who died from food poisoning, or poisoning. What shall we put on his tombstone?" And I believe they just put Warren G. Harding. I remember when I was attending a funeral in Arlington Cemetery of Frank Knox, who was the Secretary of the Navy. I didn't go out there for his funeral, but they said Eleanor Roosevelt would be there. So I went out specifically to see what Eleanor looked like, I recall. And she looked the same as in her pictures and didn't add much to the funeral. And I was quite excited. However, they laid Frank Knox away, and so Eleanor also went away. It was a great time. I remember I was in a small town, and my car broke down, and I didn't know what to do, and the garage owner said it would take 3 hours to fix the car. I spied a Baptist church across the street with a funeral going on. And I had a lot of time to kill, so I went on waiting for my car to be fixed. I sat in the back row of the church, and the minister announced, he said, anyone who wished may get up and give a eulogy for the deceased. So immediately I stood up. I said, I have never known the deceased. I was never acquainted with him. But since we got a lot of time to kill here, I'd like to talk to you all about South Dakota. So I came out of the church, and here was the undertaker who gave the hearse driver instructions to take the hearse to the cemetery. However, the hearse driver went through a plate glass window in a drugstore, and the caskets lit up in front of the counter, and the man in the casket sat up, and the clerk came and said, may I help you? And the man in the casket said, yeah, have you got anything to stop this coffin? Funeral which I attended. It was a funeral of funerals, I believe. This funeral was for a lowly, humble man, and the pastor announced, he said, it was an old Norwegian pastor, and he made a mistake in his sermon, and he said, the shell is here, but the nut is gone. However, then, the great funeral which I attended was a farmer who had in his lifetime been very excited about living, but he didn't like the cold weather in North Dakota. So he had his land surveyed and found that the land fell in South Dakota. He was on the border of North and South Dakota. And the people came and said, why are you celebrating? And he said, because now that I'm in South Dakota, I can get away from all those blizzards up in North Dakota. But anyway, they laid him to rest safely away from all the storms and blizzards of the Midwest. And I recall another great funeral of a Japanese politician that I knew. I attended this funeral because I wanted to see what Japanese did when they laid their beloved away. I came to this house, and Mama-san was there, and bowed, took me in, and gave me a dish of rice. And I wondered, what in the world is the rice for? Because they didn't throw it on me when I came into the house. And I found out that was to eat in honor of the dearly loved departed. Now we have all been patriotic here today. We have sent our food to the front. Known as the Battle of the Bulge. Today we pause to remember the great funeral of Dan McGrew, right? Sam McGee.
That's right.
Sam McGee.
Yes,
they threw him in a furnace. That poem by Robert Service. And I believe he stuck his head out of the door later. What did he say?
Don't let all that cold air in here.
Yes, thank you. So Well, that was another great funeral in the Northland. We pause to remember this today. And I think of that grave in Deadwood of Wild Bill Hickok and Calamity Jane, and I read the account of their funeral. And the newspaper said that probably Wild Bill Hickok would shudder if he knew that Calamity Jane was buried next to him and roll over twice. It was indeed a great honor to stand at the grave of Calamity Jane and Wild Bill Hickok in Deadwood. But as I was standing there at the grave, I saw a big booth that said Chamber of Commerce. And I thought to myself, and saw all these cars coming up the side of the mountain to view the grave of Wild Bill Hickok. And here in this booth, sponsored by the Chamber of Commerce, they were selling picture postcards. And I thought to myself, you can't beat a picture postcard to send to a relative if they haven't been there. I want to say during this speech about my hometown of Webster, South Dakota. The place was so dead, they put a fence around it because they thought it was a cemetery. They thought people were dying to get in. Let us pause to review other famous funerals. Of the jazz band leader, when they played, had the jazz band. And they one number I recall, I think they played, was When the Saints Come Marching In. And I thought of that this morning as I would be staring into your lovely faces and thought about when all the saints come marching into this building here. Anyway, they laid him away with fanfare and rejoicing, and certainly it wasn't a place of sorrow, it was a place of joy. And that jazz band, I think I heard the recording of it played on the radio. And so more saints have come in than have gone out today. As we look at the great American funerals, there was one which strikes my mind today, was Theodore Roosevelt when they bore him away. He was a huge man, and I remember the paper accounts, the old papers stating how they had borne him away. And one man had made the comment that probably he was one of the stoutest presidents, heaviest presidents, that ever hit the White House. Anyway. But a reporter once had an interview with Theodore Roosevelt, and he asked his friend, "I'm very nervous. What shall I say? What should I do when I meet the great president, Theodore Roosevelt?" And he said, "Just imagine him in long johns like everybody else, and you will have a pleasant interview." So the reporter went to the White House and calmed his nerves and shook hands and was laughing furiously. And so was the president, Roosevelt, laughing furiously. But the reporter was thinking all along that how he looked like any other person in long johns. And Theodore Roosevelt just laughed. There are other accounts of famous men and famous funerals. I believe the one of Herbert Hoover, who was interred in Long Branch, Iowa. He had a simple grave. There's a simple little house there. And that, as I recall, is just a simple grave like you and I would like to have. I recall another famous funeral. I believe it was this lady evangelist down in California when they carried her away. They were all singing. It was Amy Semple McPherson. She was found on a beach, laying on a beach. They don't know what caused her death. It might have been sleeping pills. It could have been anything. But this was truly a great funeral. She was the one who had the motorcycles going up and down the aisles. She had angels parading in her temple. She had collection plates in wash tubs. She liked the green stuff. And they said of her when she died, truly, she was a great woman. There are other accounts of famous funerals. But I want to say this today about one day I was in Webster, South Dakota, and driving by the cemetery, and someone said to me, "Yeah, your relatives are all laying out there." So I said, "Well, probably that's the place where I'll be laying too, and raised from the dead." And that will be, and I thought to myself today, that will be another famous funeral. Truly, folks, it's been a great honor and pleasure to be here today. We remember all these great funerals, the processions, the bands, the hearses, the flags, as they bore these great presidents and these great people away to their hole in the ground. I hope today that this talk was not too dead, not informative. As one undertaker once said one time, "Business has been very dead lately." So I close this little speech and we go on our way doing nothing and eating some more, digging our graves with our teeth. It has been a pleasure to be with you today, and I hope that we can get together the next 4th of July and talk about these other holes in the ground which we missed. Cough drop to time his sermon, which took 10 minutes. One Sunday morning, he preached for an hour and discovered he had made a mistake and used a bucket. Only one more. There was this preacher that was preaching a Sunday morning sermon, and he preached on and on for hour. He said, "Brothers and sisters, I'm sorry to tell you I lost my watch and didn't know what time it was." And somebody shouted from the audience, "That's all right, brother. There's a calendar hanging on the wall." This Lutheran preacher who was looking for a job. He was retired. He couldn't find a job and couldn't meet and make ends meet. So he looked in the paper and he saw one ad. It said, "Wanted worker in zoo." So he went down to the zoo and the zookeeper said, "Yes, we have a job for you. Our old gorilla died. We can't afford a new gorilla, but we have a suit for you which you may wear and entertain the kids. You have the job." So he put on the suit and was swinging in the trees when he fell in the lion's cage. And the lion was chasing him and the preacher was screaming and howling. And the lion edged up to him and said, "Cool it, man. You're not the only Lutheran preacher out of work."